start by mentioning that last Friday afternoon, I did review how one study after another has attempted to model the future, from Thomas Malthus in 1797 to the Global 2000 report, dated 1980. And each of these studies has forecast various forms of disaster, quote, if present trends continue, end quote. Present trends in population, food, energy, mineral resources, and pollution. Now, those who dislike or disagree with such prospects call these models of doom. Today, I would like to look at what prospects for hope may be found in the studies themselves and in the writings of a few of the critics of these studies. So today, the title is Global 2000, Where's the Hope? Now, the first systematic inquiry into these related problems was Harrison Brown, The Challenge of Man's Future, published in 1954. And at that time, he gave us the possibility of developing a worldwide free industrial society in which human beings can live in reasonable harmony with their environment. He warns us that this will be difficult to achieve and difficult to maintain if we get it, but says that it is within our power. And he cautions us that we must encourage the emergence of new ideas. And we should not fear change, but we need to exercise some choice in what the change may be. The same author came back a number of years later, and in 1978 published The Human Future Revisited. And among his conclusions, after talking about what may happen if industrial civilization survives or why it might not, in spite of the gloomy outlook, the fact remains that we have it within our power to create a world in which hunger and poverty are eliminated, in which all people can live comfortably in environments which are not only clean but beautiful, in which people are free to move about as they please, read and write what they please, and live in cultural environments of their own choosing. Although the creation of such a world lies well within our technological capabilities and well within the resource base which our technology can unlock, the task of achieving it, nevertheless, is a prodigious one. Two preconditions are essential for success. First, the long time scale must be appreciated. We're talking about one or more centuries. Second, there must be the political will to get the job done in spite of the long time scale. This latter precondition may well turn out to be the real stumbling block. So he seems to be saying that we can do it if we are convinced of the necessity and have the will, which certainly sounds like there should be hope there. Now, a study which attracted a great deal more attention than The Challenge of Man's Future in 1954 was the first of the popular accounts of computer modeling, The Limits to Growth, 1972. The very cover says, the headline-making report on the imminent global disaster facing humanity and what we can do about it before time runs out. It says right there on the cover, it's not hopeless. We know what we're facing. We can do something about it. Their small, relatively small computer model did show that we could get a stabilized behavior without crash and disaster within the next 100, 200 years if we did a number of things: set the birth rate equal to the death rate, economically set the investment rate equal to the depreciation rate, limiting growth deliberately. Cut our consumption and pollution per unit of production to a quarter of its 1970 value, and made other choices which favor the production of food and of services rather than of manufactured goods. They see, though, that we have to accept the limits to growth imposed by nature in a finite world. We have to do that, in their view, by imposing a deliberate and controlled end to growth, that we have to achieve an equilibrium state, according to their view. But the hope there is that they say, again, it could be done, although the practical problems in doing so get to be rather overwhelming. My friend and colleague Bob Stivers from the PLU Religion Department in The Sustainable Society describes the need to achieve that status as taking as many steps as possible toward the sustainable society, being careful never to let the possible limit our imagination, or to let social pessimism undercut the imperative for action. The same year as The Limits to Growth came out, a book was published with quite a contrary point of view. It was called The Doomsday Syndrome, and it was a reaction not to The Limits to Growth, that wasn't out yet, but to things like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, writings of Barry Commoner and others, which the author John Maddox viewed as the Doomsday Syndrome and said were really overdoing their scare tactics. He says, quote, that the doomsday cause would be more telling if it were more securely grounded in facts, better informed by a sense of history and an awareness of economics, and less cataclysmic in temper. He viewed as intemperate the prophecies of Ehrlich, for example, who said that whatever we did starting back in 1968, that hundreds of millions would inevitably starve to death during the 1970s. Well, Maddox didn't see it happening in 1972. It didn't happen, in fact. Maddox viewed the depletion of resources, that's one of the things that the limits to growth type of model assumes, but he said that every time somebody prophesies an end to the resources, that end always seems to be receding just over the horizon as you go forward. He says that the real economic cost of resources has been decreasing, not increasing, and that we actually have been using less of our emotional energy to fight the poverty and injustice and avoidable death of the present than we have been spending in worrying about possible catastrophes that very likely will not happen or have been predicted and did not happen. He points out that pollution was already declining by a number of measures in cities in the U.S., and that would be before the 1970 Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act really had a chance to take effect. Those who prophesied doomsday are called Neo-Malthusians after Thomas Malthus. Maddox reminds us that by Thomas Malthus's second edition, published in 1803, he recognized that humans do, in fact, historically limit their population growth in the face of scarce resources, although the original 1797 Malthus pamphlet is the one that's primarily quoted. Furthermore, Maddox takes the point of view that population growth contributes to the economy by having more people, more markets, and that as economic development takes place, historically birth rates have and do decline. As far as running out of energy resources, Maddox calls estimating the amounts of fossil fuels in the surface of the earth is like estimating the number of undetected murders. You really don't know what's there that hasn't been found. And makes the statement in 1972, mind you, that energy is now more plentiful and cheaper than it ever has been. Moreover, there is no reason why it should not continue to become more plentiful and cheaper in every sense that matters. Remember that when we come to a more recent author. Well, what next? Next should probably be mankind at the turning point, 1972, the second report to the Club of Rome. But I did want to say another word or two now that I've found the right piece of paper from Maddox. In this edition, he has a postscript dealing with limits to the growth because he had time to read it and write about it after his own book was published the same year. He says that Dr. Gunnar Myrdal, the famous Swedish sociologist and commentator, was quite right in describing limits to growth as pretentious nonsense. Says it's oversimplified, so much is lumped together that there's no point in paying any attention at all to what those folks say. Well, in the second report to the Club of Rome, a more elaborate model didn't lump things together anymore. What signs of hope might be found there? These authors say that affluence is hunger's main competitor for the available food supply. And many times we hear that it takes 7 to 10 times the amount of grain protein to produce a pound of grain-fed meat protein. We recognize that in the diet that we make available at Holden Village. In a way, that could be, from my point of view, a considerable sign of hope. Look at all the food that would be available if and when needed, assuming that we can modify our own appetites, and as these authors point out, assuming that we can quit inflicting irreparable damage on nature so that food can continue to be produced in the future as it has been. In the epilogue to this report, the authors say that we cannot afford to wait for change to occur spontaneously and fortuitously. Rather, we must initiate on our own changes of necessary but tolerable magnitude in time to avert intolerably massive and externally generated change. A strategy for such change can be evolved only in the spirit of truly global cooperation, shaped in free partnership by the world's diverse regional communities, and guided by a rational master plan for long-term organic growth. In other words, no longer must we say absolutely have to stop growth, but simply we have to manage the growth into a direction that can be continued. All our computer simulations have shown quite clearly that this is the only sensible and feasible approach to avoid major regional and ultimately global catastrophe, and that the time that can be wasted before developing such a global world system is running out. Clearly, the only alternatives are division and conflict, hate and destruction. Alternatives, though, to a plan which they say, if we will, we can do. Yes. When they talk about regions in this book, they've divided the world into 12 regions. They are pretty big, and they do interact. Those interactions are built into their 100,000 equations in their computer model. So they're avoiding the problem of taking a world average of everything, which can be misleading. The old saw that if you have 1 foot in a bucket of ice water and the other on a hot stove, on the average, you're comfortable. Furthermore, these people have in their model capability to construct scenarios, what ifs, and see what the results would be of such specific changes as applying a certain greater percentage towards savings, towards agricultural development, towards manufacturing development, tax rates, whatever. They can play with all of those possibilities, and they've been going around trying to get leaders in the world to sit down with them and play these games to get some idea of what, in fact, might result from various policy options that might be available. Now, these people, of course, are academic people who are doing a study reporting to the Club of Rome, but they aren't the Club of Rome. In the back of this edition, which is from the Holden Library, there is a commentary by the leadership of the Club of Rome, Aurelio Pace and Alexander King, who most warmly welcome this report, and who have this to say about it. The conclusions of the first global research, that is, the limits to growth, were generally taken to be a prophecy of doom, despite the repeated statements of the book itself, that the purpose of the project was indeed to elucidate the consequences of continuing as at present in order to provoke change, which would render these conclusions invalid. They wanted people to listen, change their ways, and not have result what they were projecting. The energy and food crises exploded in the meantime with such vicious force that they cut short much of the hasty criticism leveled against this exercise. While readily recognizing the inevitable imperfection of the MIT pioneering effort, we regard it as a milestone. Not the least significant result is that world attention has begun to consider seriously the basic issues raised by the report. It will be recognized, of course, that these in the second study are still prototype models. Masarevich and Pestel have assumed a Herculean task. The full implementation of their work will take many years of trial and error and intellectual ingenuity, and will in the end require a comprehensive bank of coherent world, national, and regional data if it is to have sufficient flexibility to allow switching in and out large numbers of relevant variables, the continuous reappraisal of data and assumptions, and the exploration of the effect that changes in the system of values would have. Results to date, however, are very important. The authors have concentrated on several clusters of problems which, if not squarely met, can alone provoke unimaginable disasters. Backed by this intensive research and study, certain basic conclusions have been reached. They confirm earlier warnings of the Club of Rome. Two of them, no fundamental readdressment of the world conditions and human prospects is possible except by worldwide cooperation in a global context and with long views. The cost, not only in economic and political terms, but in human suffering as well, which will result from delay in taking early decisions, are simply monstrous. Many of the decisions for survival which must be taken in this spirit will inevitably be unpopular and some impossible to achieve, unless there is universal understanding of the nature of our problems and their gravity. The importance of this book is manifest under both these aspects. On the one hand, it explicitly lays bare the alternatives ahead, showing the urgency of making responsible choices. On the other hand, it has developed a learning and operative instrument which can assist us in making these choices. So, it is for these reasons that we recommend this report to the political class and to the public. At the same time, we express the hope resources made available to develop further these techniques so that those of us who have the tremendous responsibility of making major decisions at this turn of history be aided to make them in the true interest of the peoples of the world today and tomorrow. Again, if we make the right choices, there's hope. A quite different approach was published in 1976, entitled The Next 200 Years, Herman Kahn and colleagues at the Hudson Institute. The scenario presented, elaborated, and tested in this book can be summarized with the general statement that 200 years ago, almost everywhere, human beings were comparatively few, poor, and at the mercy of the forces of nature. And 200 years from now, we expect, almost everywhere they will be numerous, rich, and in control of the forces of nature. So, a great deal of optimism, in fact, here. As part of our study, we have developed two perspectives on the future, which many might judge to be optimistic, but which we consider quite realistic. While events may not follow either of these two perspectives, we do think they provide good ways to examine current trends. One perspective, which we call Earth-centered, assumes that for the next 200 years, the vast majority of the human population will continue to inhabit the Earth. The other perspective, entitled Spacebound, assumes that the eventual establishment of large autonomous colonies in space, but their conclusions don't depend upon that outcome. So they focused on the first perspective. So they assert that the transition that they foresee, the resolution of many current problems, can be accomplished by what is available to us here on Earth in terms of both living space and resources. They argue that the growth first of population and later of gross world product will be this flattened S-shaped curve, not the unlimited growth until disaster, but will shortly, if it is not already, level off from the normal course of events and level off to a point where, give or take a factor of 2 to 5, they project that in 200 years, there will be 15 billion people on the Earth instead of 4-some billion. That there will be, in 1975 dollars, a $300 trillion gross world product compared to $5.5 trillion in 76. And that there will be a per capita income, which in 76 was $1,300 worldwide, would be, in constant dollars, $20,000 per capita. That is, nearly everywhere rich, abundant people in control of the forces of nature. Well, they don't have a computer model. They don't have a methodology. They make what they call surprise-free projections that, assuming that present trends continue, everything's going to be rosy, not disastrous. They are serious, yes. Now, some people then have hope. There's a perhaps entirely different kind of hope inherent in some of the discussion I heard in 1979 at the World Council of Churches Conference on Faith, Science, and the Future, held at MIT, where an economist from Louisiana State University, Herman Daly, presented a paper on the economics of a just and sustainable society. started out by distinguishing between wishful thinking, that's the idea that whatever is desirable must also be possible, and technological determinism, that is, assuming that whatever is possible must also be desirable. Said we should avoid both of these, but that the two sets of things desirable and things possible do intersect, but we have to look out for crossing the boundary so that we may be in a realm where things are either not possible or not desirable. Said that much worry people exercise about running out of non-renewable resources, which eventually, by definition, you've got to run out of, but that the more crucial problem is with the destruction of the renewable resources, the capacity for regeneration, especially of the Earth's capability for growing food. He views a sustainable economy, again, as something which must be achieved and has to be based on a renewable resource base, and that the population and per capita consumption in that sustainable economy must be within the limits of the carrying capacity of the Earth. He views an ever-growing standard of consumption for an ever-growing population as being something impossible. Without the services of the poor 82% of the world, the rich 18%, us, could not possibly maintain their wealth. So he sees limiting economic growth as a moral necessity. Said the poor need to limit their population growth but continue their economic growth until they reach the state of sufficiency. Good Holden word. The rich must also limit their population growth and reduce their consumption down to a state of sufficiency. If you use the greatest good for the greatest number as a criterion for social choice, he thinks that that is not something you really can achieve, because you can only maximize one thing at a time. Only one can be greatest, not two. So he would replace that goal as one of sufficient product for the greatest number of people over time. But again, this greatest number of people he views as having to be kept within a carrying capacity of the earth, and that there's no way that the greatest per capita product for the greatest number of people now can lead to a sustainable society. The first response to this presentation was from C.T. Kurian from India, and he took exception to many of the assumptions, not just of Daly's paper, but of the conference itself, the full title of which would be Faith, Science, and the Future in a Just, Participatory, and Sustainable Society. Kurian said that a bigger cake does not automatically give everybody a bigger piece. He said that if you claim to be concerned about the unborn humanity you cannot see, but show no regard for the humanity you see about you, you are a liar. He said that the poor of the earth use little of these scarce resources that you're worrying about running out of in limits to growth. Said if all of the petroleum and coal and copper in the world are used up, the poor would survive. It would make very little difference to them. Survival of the fittest probably doesn't mean the fattest. So he asks, in whose name do we call for limits to growth and a sustainable society, if not to sustain the riches of the rich? I suppose if you're poor, you might regard that as grounds for hope. The things that we over here are worrying about aren't really going to matter. What about the Global 2000 report, which is what I'm supposed to be talking about, but I go through all these preliminaries because they so resemble what goes into and what comes out of the Global 2000 report itself. This particular special edition for Pergamon Press has a preface written by the director of the study, Lutheran layman named Gerald Barney, who describes a little more fully what was in his mind, as well as some of the history and frustration of carrying out what needed to be a 2-year study, was allowed to be a 1-year study by the time they got started in order to get it printed by the end of the year. It would have given him 6 months to do, and so that's why it didn't come out quite on schedule. Anyhow, the first 4 words, "if present trends continue," he explains in this way. "My concern focused not so much on the projections that come out of the study as on the president's purpose for the study, to establish the foundation of our longer-term planning. I argued that the report from any study, especially one done with a non-governmental model or in only 6 months, could not provide a foundation for U.S. planning. The needed foundation would have to consist not so much of the report, per se, but of data, models, and skilled personnel. I argued that the study process for the Global 2000 study could establish a meaningful and useful foundation if, to the fullest extent possible, the study was performed by U.S. government personnel using U.S. government data and U.S. government models, rather than, for example, the world integrated model that was the basis for mankind at the turning point and has been undergoing continual refinement ever since. 2 other important decisions were made in the first weeks. One concerned policy, the other technology. Mr. Warren, a veteran of many years in the California legislature, had observed that nothing happens in government when a study is based on the assumption that laws and policies will be changed. As he put it, the legislators look at the happy ending and do nothing. Mr. Warren decreed, very wisely, I think, that the Global 2000 study would assume a continuation of present policies. In other words, they aren't providing the variety of scenarios in that study to see what can be done if policy changes are made. As for technology, we decided to ask the agencies to make whatever technological assumptions they normally make in developing long-term projections. We later reviewed these assumptions and found that the agencies are generally assuming a continuation of rapid rates of technological advance. The Department of Agriculture, for example, projects yields per acre to continue increasing throughout the foreseeable future at rates comparable to the peak increases achieved during the Green Revolution. The Department of Energy assumes implicitly that rapid advances in nuclear technology will substantially reduce public concern and construction delays, allowing nuclear power generating facilities to be tripled over the 1975-1990 period. And for this reason, he points out that some of the conclusions of the study that sound so gloomy may in fact be overly optimistic. However, once again, the conclusions are only if we don't pay any attention and go on with business as usual. Indeed, the problems of preserving the carrying capacity of the earth and sustaining the possibility of a decent life for the human beings that inhabit it are enormous and close upon us. Yet there is reason for hope. It must be emphasized that the Global 2000 study's projections are based on the assumption that national policies regarding population stabilization, resource conservation, and environmental protection will remain essentially unchanged through the end of the century. But in fact, policies are beginning to change, In some areas, forests are being replanted after cutting. Some nations are taking steps to reduce soil losses and desertification. Interest in energy conservation is growing, and large sums are being invested in exploring alternatives to petroleum dependence and several others. Encouraging as these developments are, they are far from adequate to meet the global challenges projected in the study. Vigorous, determined new initiatives are needed if worsening poverty and human suffering, environmental degradation, and international tension and conflicts are to be prevented. There are no quick fixes. The only solutions to the problems of population, resources, and the environment are complex and long-term. These problems are inextricably linked to some of the most perplexing and persistent problems in the world: poverty, injustice, and social conflict. New and imaginative ideas and a willingness to act on them are essential. But again, it does say, if we make the right choices, pursue the right policies, that solutions are possible, that effective action can be taken. Now, for the next portion of what I have to say, the subtitle is Simon Says. The year after the Global 2000 report was published, there was published a book called The Ultimate Resource by Julian Simon, an economist at the University of Illinois. And he takes a point of view, quite the opposite of the computer model studies, but not unlike some of the others that I already quoted today, so that we can see some of the similarities. Right there on the cover, natural resources and energy are getting less scarce. He says that the projections and the computer models have gotten into trouble because they use technological forecasts that are based on known reserves, how much petroleum or whatever has been found. Well, you don't find reserves until you look for them. You don't look for them until you need them. And all of the size of the known reserves depend on our present rate of use and the present cost and have nothing whatsoever to say about the future. That if you take the economist's perspective, which he is, you get quite a different picture. Scarcity, he defines economically, as in terms of its cost of some resource relative to other things like wages or costs of other goods. And on that basis, he points out that any resource you look at, renewable or non-renewable, has been getting less scarce rather than more scarce since 1800. The cost has been going down. Energy, minerals, food, whatever. Well, won't we run out someday? That's the assumption made specifically in a number of the things that I have quoted from. He says, no, we won't run out eventually, because we'll find something else to use to do the same job. Well, how can he be so sure we will? Well, there aren't any absolute guarantees in anybody's predictions. But, says, that we always have. And there's no reason to assume that it will be different in the future, based on at least his best knowledge and judgment. I was struck by how almost direct a quote it is from a book 10 years ago. He said, so the average American uses 90 times as much of some resources as the average Asian. From his perspective, the average American also creates a great deal more of these resources, in the sense of finding more or finding something else to do the job. And on the average, since we aren't running out, but resources are getting more abundant rather than scarcer, then more is being created by those who use them. He points out the forecast that I mentioned of Ehrlich in 1968, that hundreds of millions would starve in the 1970s. He said, if you look at the data, U.S. data, U.N. data, the only data there are you will see that between 1948 and 1979, the world has achieved an increase of 40% in the amount of food available per person. That even the developing countries have kept pace with population growth in their food production. There where the population growth has been the most rapid, but not where the food production growth has been the most rapid. He said that in the long run, if you look at 100 or 200 years of history, food also has been getting cheaper, not scarcer. And that those dismal figures you hear quoted of 100,000 starving in the drought in the Sahel, of two-thirds of humanity going to bed hungry each night, he said that those statements are not backed up by any data whatsoever. So, the world's food supply is improving. He said all the data there are bear that out. Pollution in the U.S. has been decreasing, and he gives data which are, I believe, quite valid to show that. Not that it happens automatically. More people cause more pollution, but social action has been taken in the U.S. to decrease rather than to allow continued increase of pollution. And his major point is that population growth has, in fact, long-term benefits. That population increase fuels prosperity. Of course, it takes 20 to 30 years for a new human being to become a productive worker, but after that length of time, having more productive workers from an increased population will give increased demand, which comes immediately from the increased population, will give increased production, and will accelerate the rate of technological advance. Technological advance depends on the human mind, which he says is very seldom found without the human body. The more bodies, the more minds, the more interaction, and the faster is technological progress. And he has graphs to show that more dense populations seem to give more rapid numbers of inventions, or however you might define technological progress, as well as more rapid economic development. Well, what about conserving resources for the future? Simon says, the only resources you need to worry about conserving are those that are either one of a kind, like the Mona Lisa or Muhammad Ali, or are in some way irreplaceable, like an endangered species can't be substituted for by something just as good. Other than those, it makes no sense to save other resources for future generations, because resources have been and will continue to become cheaper and less scarce in the future than now. And in fact, the better off we are now from using these resources, the stronger base those in the future will have on which to build. Well, what about our exploiting other countries by buying raw materials from them? He said that that is the way that they can get the means to buy food from us, or manufactured goods from us, or other things that they need, and that there's no reason why both parties shouldn't gain from all these transactions. He does point out that establishing what a fair price is brings in a realm of values which the economist is not equipped to define, but must be arrived at in other ways. Furthermore, if raw materials continue, as they have been, to get cheaper and more abundant year by year, then those countries will lose by holding on to the resources themselves till their own people might need them, because the resources won't be worth as much then as they are now. Well, as we see, this is quite the opposite of the Limits to Growth, Global 2000. The book was published in 1981 and does talk about the limits to growth in these words. The limits to growth simulation, which has us breeding to the exhaustion of resources, is not worth detailed discussion or criticism. But it is a fascinating example of how scientific work can be outrageously bad and yet be very influential. The limits to growth has been blasted as foolishness or fraud by almost every economist who has read it closely and reviewed it in print, for its silly methods as well as for disclosing so little of what the authors did, which makes close inspection impossible. To use their sort of language, the whole limits to growth caper is a public relations hype kicked off with the press conference. Well, as far as economists' opinion of limits to growth book itself, I don't know. But I do know that economists such as Barbara Ward and Kenneth Boulding, who I've heard each of them credited with coining the phrase spaceship Earth, Herman Daly, who I've quoted, Robert Heilbronner, certainly take the limits to growth position and have consistently and have written books for the public saying why. One strong reason not to put stock in the limits to growth predictions is that the model was quickly shown to produce rosy forecasts with minor and realistic changes in the assumptions. Well, he doesn't back that up here any more than limits to growth backs theirs up in that particular book. The most compelling criticism of the limits to growth simulation, however, was made by the sponsoring Club of Rome itself. Just 4 years after the furore created by the book's publication and huge circulation, an incredible 4 million copies were sold, the Club of Rome, quote, reversed its position, quote, and, quote, came out for more growth, end quote. But this about-face has gotten relatively little attention, even though it was written up in such places as Time and the New York Times. And so the original message is the one that remains with most people. The explanation of this reversal is reported in Time. The club's founder, the Italian industrialist Aurelio Pacei, says Limits was intended to jolt people from the comfortable idea that present growth trends could continue indefinitely. That done, he says, the club could then seek ways to close the widening gap between rich and poor nations, inequities that, if they continue, could all too easily lead to famine, pollution, and war. The club's startling shift, Pacei says, is thus not so much a turnabout as part of an evolving strategy. In other words, the Club of Rome sponsored and disseminated untruths in an attempt to scare us. Having scared so many people with these lies, the club can now tell people the real truth. Surely this is one of the more curious episodes of recent years. The Limits to Growth authors have not recanted, to my knowledge, even though their sponsors have. But neither did the authors confront and contradict their sponsors when the sponsors recanted. Well, he's referring 4 years later, must be 1976. In 1976, I heard Dennis Meadows debate Herman Kahn, and Dennis Meadows had not changed his general point of view one bit. He certainly had not recanted. In 1979, I attended a four-day short course with Mihailo Masarevich and one of his colleagues from Case Western Reserve. What they have done is to extend, expand, and enhance the model they use and come out with the same kinds of conclusions, only more firmly grounded in their point of view. I'm not sure whether Simon was at the first of these. I am sure Simon wasn't at the second. He dismisses the Global 2000 report similarly as not worth refuting. Said that they don't have the data they themselves say they would need. And he's just afraid that people might be misled. Yet this study is being heavily ballyhooed and will surely form the basis for many policy decisions in coming years. Well, if that's true, then that may be a sign of hope if you believe the Global 2000. Or, of course, if you believe what Simon says, then there's all sorts of signs of hope there. His last words, "I do not say that all is well. Children are hungry and sick. People live out lives of physical and intellectual poverty, and lack of opportunity, war, or some new pollution may do us all in. What I am saying is that for most of the relevant economic matters I have checked, the trends are positive rather than negative. And I doubt that it does the troubled people of the world any good to say that things are getting worse, though they really are getting better. And false prophecies of doom can damage us in many ways. Is a rosy future guaranteed? Of course not. There always will be temporary shortages and resource problems where there are strife, political blundering, and natural calamities, that is, where there are people. But the natural world allows and the developed world promotes through the marketplace responses to human needs and shortages in such manner that one backward step leads to 1.0001 steps forward or thereabouts. That's enough to keep us headed in a life-sustaining direction. The main fuel to speed our progress is our stock of knowledge, and the brake is our lack of imagination. The ultimate resource is people, skilled, spirited, and hopeful people who will exert their wills and imaginations for their own benefit, and so inevitably for the benefit of us all." Well, what do you think? Have world conditions been getting worse or better in, say, the last couple hundred years or so? Have the gloomy forecasts been contradicted by later events? Has human ingenuity been underestimated? Whose side do you come down on? Seeing no other hands, I'd like to give the last word to my friend and colleague Bob Stivers in the Sustainable Society, available in the bookstore or the library. "Yet there is hope. Should all these factors cause Christians to respond with pessimism? By no means. Even if subsequent events prove our hopes unfounded, to respond with pessimism ahead of time is pragmatically foolish. It cuts the ethical cord by eliminating positive choice. Moreover, pessimism can never be the stance of one who believes that God is at work in the world. Pessimism is the stance of one who has lost real hope. For the person who trusts in God's work of love, hope is never lost. But neither should we be optimistic. It is necessary in this context to distinguish between hope and optimism, realism and pessimism. Realism can be distinguished from pessimism in that, while both emphasize the factors in human existence that offer resistance to the realization of goals, realism can be maintained without losing the element of hope. One can be realistic about human pride and self-centeredness without turning them into a determinism. The consistent pessimist sees no way out, nothing to motivate behavior to seek even realizable goals." But where really are we to find a firm basis for hope? The pessimist easily rebuts even guarded optimism. "We also know that God is judge and that his wrath will descend on our pride, on our refusal to treat our neighbors justly, and on our continuing exploitation of the environment. Nevertheless, Christians also know God as Redeemer, as the one who is merciful beyond judgment, as the one who works through love to overcome pride and sloth. It is this assurance that God is Redeemer upon which our hopes ultimately rest. We believe that God's love and our response will provide the resources to overcome the forces of destruction even in the most threatening situations. This does not mean a future of cornucopian abundance, nor does it mean that we can sit back and let God do it. God simply doesn't work that way. We are free, free to affirm or deny Christ's lordship. God does not intervene like the Lone Ranger or Superman to reconcile what our denial of him has alienated. God's mercy and love are effective in persons and communities only with confession, repentance, and acceptance of new life. God now calls us to repentance and new direction. His call is to throw off the determinism of the past and the rigid, encrusted structures of the present. His call is to an open future where we can be assured he will be present. Problems and promises, we have enough of each to be realistic without despair, hopeful without illusion. Both the problems and the promises challenge us. The promises call us to find just and creative solutions to the problems. The problems push us to the limits of our ability to respond, taxing our imagination, creativity, and compassion. We are realistic because we know the past, but even more, we are hopeful because we are sure of the future.